Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The Gilcrease Museum opened a new exhibit this past weekend devoted to one of America's finest contemporary artists and landscape painters. Kay Walkingstick, an American artist, is a retrospective of this artist's work spanning close to 40 years in a career that has explored her cultural identity, engaging with her indigenous heritage, while simultaneously inhabiting the contemporary art movements of her time. Within the 60 or so odd artworks featured in the exhibit, you can see pop and mod influences, minimalism, abstract work, along with her beautiful and arresting contemporary landscapes. Within the exhibit, you can see some of her best-known works, the Chief Joseph series, a series of almost sculptural, minimalist paintings featuring a series of arc images, as well as her diptychs, which include the juxtaposition of a contemporary American landscape with an abstract work, both using the same color palette. The exhibit was created by the Smithsonian's National Museum of the American Indian and the American Federation of Art, and it runs at Gilcrease through January 7th. I'm joined by Senior Curator and Curator for Art at the Museum, Laura Fry, to discuss this amazing American artist and her work. Laura Fry, welcome back to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for the invitation.
This new exhibit devoted to Kay Walkingstick is just really spectacular. For those who don't know Kay Walkingstick, tell us a little bit about her.
Kay Walkingstick is a contemporary artist. She's now 82 years old, and she has been working since the 60s and 70s. And she's a painter, working with a variety of media. And this exhibition is a retrospective, so it includes some of the works from the early 1970s all the way up through 2012.
And really innovative in the way she uses Native American iconography, as well as an amazing landscape painter, but also you see her range of searching for new ways of expression through her entire career. I think that's probably the most interesting thing about this exhibit is you can always see her saying, okay, I'm starting out figurative. I'm starting out very pop influenced in many ways. You know, she has an abstract period. She comes back to sort of a minimalist period. And then she kind of goes back to perhaps what might've been her first love is painting landscapes.
Yes, and what's so exciting about this work is the variety of influences that she incorporates over her career. And Kay was raised in Syracuse, New York, but she's half Cherokee and half white. And even though her Cherokee father was, her parents had separated, so her father was largely absent, but her mother really instilled in the family and in her children an appreciation of their Cherokee heritage. And that was something that became very important to Kay, especially as she was developing as an artist. So there's influences from Native American history, from Native American artwork in her painting, but there's also influences from the Italian Renaissance and from minimalism. And it's a really wonderful array of works and ideas that she's pulling together.
Yeah. Now, the very first piece you see is a very large piece. It's called the New Mexican Desert, which is sort of emblematic of what she's been doing over the last 5 to 10 years. It's a spectacular canvas, beautiful New Mexico colors with the gold, the browns, and the blue sky. But on the bottom, there's these little Native American symbols or...
Yes, she in recent years, Kay's been influenced by and turning to the American landscape and really looking all over the country. But she's been doing a series of recognizable places like the Southwest Desert and then placing patterns pulled from traditional Native American artworks over top of a landscape and combining landscape with pattern with other imagery. And it's her way of placing Native Americans back into these landscapes and saying that these are inherently Native places.
Now, from that opening piece, you go back to some of her early work in the, I would say, 1971, 1970, and she's very much influenced by pop art. We're seeing these multiple images. There's one of like a 6 or 8 pairs of feet done in typical pop colors, and they're self-portraits in a way, but they're also sort of relating to, I don't know if it's pop or psychedelic colors, you know, but it's that 1960s, 70s color scheme, I guess.
Yes. Yeah. She did a series of paintings in the early 70s of figures, and these are somewhat self-portraits, and they use these, you know, sort of beautiful pastel bright colors. They look like ice cream sherbet. They're these sort of these jewel tones, and they're very flat colors. They resemble almost a screen print, even though these are paintings. And they're certainly pulling from those bright, vivid colors of pop art, but also using those to create figures. This is also the era of minimalism, of artists really reducing art to its most basic abstract form. And instead of going that direction, she's incorporating figures and self-portraits into her work.
Yeah, and silhouettes. Mm-hmm. In fact, some nudes. And I was looking at one called The Fantasy for a January Day, which sort of harkens back to German Expressionism with the poses of the nudes, with the sort of Egon Schiele-like, you know, where it's legs splayed, body completely exposed. But again, it's in the silhouette form.
Yes, it's her work is very sensual, but it's not really an overt sexuality, but it's definitely exploring the figure and the outline of the figure. And so they're still fairly abstracted. It's not, I wouldn't call these explicit, but I think they do a really beautiful job of exploring the figure and kind of the emotions around the figure, and even while using very basic forms and shapes.
And there's also, during that time, there's a piece called Hudson Reflections, which is interesting because you're going to see this imagery show up over time. But in this case, it's done in these oranges and bright yellows. And you know, again, it's this sort of pop and psychedelic color scheme, if you will.
Yeah, it's a
day glow color, if you will.
Yeah, absolutely. And it almost looks like a sort of neon camouflage pattern from a distance. But it's a painting of the light reflecting on the surface of the Hudson River. Kay was working in New York and spending time crossing the bridges to and from Manhattan and Brooklyn. And it's this sort of orange light reflecting on the water, which is, you know, perhaps also a comment on how we're treating our environment, too. So it's this beautiful image, but when you think about it being the surface of a river, it's maybe a little bit unsettling, and there's a little more going on there.
One of the things I keep coming to is this sort of experimentation, and also near there is a, and they may have environmental elements too, but a piece called Who Stole My Sky? And it's this series of stacked canvases, each of which show a sort of puffy white clouds on a blue sky background. But at the middle, there's this sort of square of just plain blue. And it's really, really an interesting image.
Yeah, and this one is has a little more overt political message. She's responding to some of the really terrible air pollution that was occurring in New York at that time period in the 1970s, and to the fact that the sky didn't have this beautiful blue appearance. And the form of the piece is also not dissimilar from, say, Jasper John's flag. And so she's instead presenting the sky as this symbol and as something to strive for, and maybe that's something that didn't exist at that time.
Now, how we look at Kay Walking Stick, we refer to as a contemporary Native American artist or American Indian artist. But I really get from her sense, yes, that's a part of it, but she's a contemporary artist first and foremost.
Yes, I was reading in the catalog for the exhibition, when she has introduced herself as an artist, it was within the last 15 years, she said she was a New York artist and a Cherokee woman. And I think that's a pretty good summary of her career and how she sees herself and her influences, is that she is absolutely a contemporary artist coming out of the New York scene, but she is at the same time someone who identifies as a Cherokee woman, and her artwork is both of those things and really is holistic.
There's one early piece in the show from 1974 called A Sensual Suggestion, and this was a series of paintings she did. This is one example of a paint-stained apron, and you see a form that's going to show up time and time again in her artwork. As I mentioned, it's an apron, but the apron strings sort of form this arc. And this becomes an important shape for her. What is the importance of the arc?
Well, she started when she was in graduate school at the Pratt Institute in Brooklyn in the 1970s. She started painting her studio apron, which was smudged with all these paint, as you might imagine from a painter's apron. And it almost became its own abstract painting. And by showing an apron, she's showing the implication of a human figure without actually showing a figure. And she was seeing the arcs from the apron string. She saw the same shape as she was driving across the bridge to Brooklyn for graduate school in the suspension rods holding up these bridges in New York. And she started taking just this very simple arc shape into a variety of abstract paintings going forward. There's several things it can represent. It's on the one side, the shorter line of the arc is this implies tension. the longer curved line is this sense of relaxation or of a, of something that's more open. That shape repeats itself throughout art history and through many different cultures. When people learned that she was Cherokee, they said, "Oh, well, that arc is clearly the shape of a bow," and well, that's just one interpretation. It could be many different things.
I don't get that sense. It doesn't strike me as that, and that seems very simplistic.
I think so. I think it's that's certainly one of many potential interpretations. But this arc became a repeated shape in much of her work, and she started doing a series of pure abstract paintings using wax and acrylic paint and many layers, and then carving this arc back into it. And these were paintings that were specifically about Native American history. She said that when she was in school in upstate New York as a child, she never learned about Native history. And so as an adult, she had to go back to research these stories herself. And she was very struck by Chief Joseph, for one. And she did, over 2 years, did a series of paintings about Chief Joseph that are purely abstract.
I would say they were minimalistic. Yep. Yeah,
yep. I mean, minimalist paintings. Each one is 15 by 20 inches. And they're a stretched canvas, and she built up layer after layer of wax and paint on the surface of each of these canvases, and then very carefully carved back through it this simple arc shape. They were very labor intensive. Like I said, the process took her 2 years, and it was almost a way of thinking about and really reflecting on the events that happened to Chief Joseph, on his role in history, and on the tragedy of his story, and a way of expressing that through this minimalist series of images. And I think it's also demonstrates that just because artwork is abstract doesn't mean it's easy to create. This is something that was a very specific process that took her quite a long time, and the end result is quite beautiful. It's tough to read in photographs. I really recommend people coming to see it in person, because it's just stunning to stand in front of this set of images.
I think you're right about that, because the texture of each of these pieces is very, very dense. And in the Chief Joseph series, you see these two pairs of vertical arcs. Two are large, two are small. And as you see through the series, she's moving them in all sorts of combinations. But again, carved into this dense texture. And multiple colors, different orders, and just sort of working through this process. Mm-hmm. I guess I'm interested in how that particular geometric shape sort of reflects Chief Joseph. And later you'll see another one that's horizontal that reflects Sacagawea, or at least she refers to that in the title. What about these geometric shapes that sort of speak to her heritage?
And again, I think it's partly just the idea of a journey of the short arc, the long arc, and tracing both something that might be arduous and very difficult, or perhaps the times in your life that might be more straightforward. And it's funny to read Kay's own writing about it. She doesn't give a very concrete, this is what the arc means, or a definition for us. And so I think she rather beautifully leaves it up to the viewer to think about these ideas and to add their own imagination and thoughts to the work. So it's I do think it's open, and to me, I see that arc as really the repetitions of the arc and all of the different patterns as being emblematic of a journey.
Yeah. And what you see at this particular time is how these strong geometric shapes play a big role in her work. There's a piece from 1975, which is actually in the Gilcrease collection, which I haven't seen all that often. It's called For John Ridge, and this is a beautiful painting. It very much in that minimalist school. In many ways, it's this black image, and it's like almost like the four corners of a tablecloth in many ways, in a sense. But unlike the Joseph and the other pieces, where this very, very, very thick texture to the surface of the work, this is very thin. It's the same process, but made very, very thin.
There's a beautiful painting called For John Ridge. And again, this is as Kay's exploring various figures from Native American history. And I think perhaps for her audience in New York, they might not have had any idea who John Ridge was. But here in Oklahoma, of course, he's more familiar to us as a Cherokee leader from the 19th century who was one of the treaty signers of the Treaty of Nuwachota, and was later murdered here in Indian Territory during some of the civil strife occurring within the Cherokee Nation, and still a controversial figure today. And this painting, it's quite large, and she first stained the canvas with a variety of red and rust-colored inks. So these are running down the canvas, and that's the background. And then on top of that, she built up layers and layers of sort of black acrylic paint mixed with wax, and then smoothed those back over, and then carved designs into that. So there's this border that is still that original ink staining surface, and it almost looks a little bit like blood. It's while this is an abstract painting, it's simply geometric shapes and colors, but you have a sense that perhaps these are blood stains. The dark, the nearly black color is certainly seems to be a sign of mourning, perhaps a representation of grief. And what, one of the things that's really interesting about this series is at that time, there were minimalist artists who were really attempting to disassociate art from emotion. They were saying artwork can just be visual. It can just be a form. It doesn't have to hold any meaning. It doesn't need emotion. And Kay, on the other hand, is placing quite a lot of emotion and meaning and feeling back into these minimalist images.
Yeah, and it does. It's taking that imagery but giving it emotion at the same time.
Very much.
Yeah, my guest today is Laura Fry, the senior curator and curator of art at Gilcrease Museum. Gilcrease presents Kay Walking Stick, an American Artist. It's on display through January 7th at the museum. It's an amazing retrospective of this artist's work. In the next room, there's two pieces which, again, will show the imagery of the paintings will show up time and time again. And this is a couple of pieces, two of which I thought were the strongest, called Montauk 1 and Montauk 2, in which you see this technique that she's worked on under the Chief Joseph series and also on the John Ridge has been now built up to sort of a big degree where she's putting found objects within the canvas like pebbles and crushed seashells. And again, this melted wax with these geometric figures that are carved into that heavy texture. This is going to play a role for about the next 15 or 20 years of her work, right?
Yes. Yeah. She starts a series, I think, in the early 1980s of really building up this wax surface on her canvas. And these are paintings, but they're also sculptures. It's starting to really shift how you define these works. And they're about 4 inches thick and covered in up to 30 layers of paint and wax. They're quite heavy. I had a chance to help move a couple of these as we were installing the show, and they are they're objects. Like they have an actual weight to them. And in all these layers of wax, she was embedding different other materials in addition to the wax and the paint. And what's interesting about them, though, while these are pure abstract paintings, most of them are named for specific locations. So she's looking at the landscape in Montauk in Long Island and creating this abstract image that's responding to the landscape.
Mm-hmm. And then she takes that next step in what is probably one of her greatest areas of these sets of diptychs, which start out involving an abstract image next to a figurative image.
Mm-hmm. Yes, she begins, I think perhaps what she's best known for are her diptych paintings. And diptych is simply the Greek word for fold. It's or twofold. So in this art form really dates back thousands of years even, but it's well known even from the medieval times and the Renaissance, having two images next to each other as part of an altarpiece or two related images. It's also pairs that you see in forms like stereoscopic photographs. And Kay is taking this idea of two panels of the same size with different imagery and pairing them together. And in the first series, she would pair a completely abstract, very thick wax built up painting next to a landscape or next to an image of figures.
With the same color palette,
yep,
too.
The same color palette. And using, in some cases, oil paint for the landscape and acrylic and wax for the abstract painting, and then placing these side by side. They're clearly related, and there's many different ways to read the pairs of images, and she also leaves that open so the viewers can bring some of their own interpretations. But it's perhaps representing the physical world, what you see in front of you, and perhaps the spiritual world, or it's representing tangible and intangible. And the tangible is the physical landscape that you exist in, that you see. The intangible might be your emotions or your spiritual reaction or feelings about that place. So it's how do you represent the intangible?
And what I find interesting about it is it's an artist with their feet in two different worlds, the abstract world and the figurative world. And what is very apparent is she is a master of both.
Very much. She's when Kate does beautiful abstract painting, but then when she goes to do a realist painting or an image of a figure or a place, she's an extremely skilled draftsman and artist. And so these both halves of these diptychs are, you know, equally successful paintings on their own. And by pairing it, she's creating a pretty interesting message about how different types of imagery can represent certain ideas.
Yeah, and I think that's the whole thing, is if you took either piece apart, they would stand alone, but obviously they're meant to go together.
Mm-hmm.
There's a section of the show which is some of the most powerful imagery, I think, in the show, and it's about the year 1989. This is her husband dies, and what you see in these pieces of artwork in this year or 2 years is grief put onto canvas. And perhaps one of the strongest pieces is, it's called The Abyss, 1989. And it features a natural landscape, probably near where she was living. She was teaching at Cornell University at the time. It's probably a ravine and a stream near where she lived.
Mm-hmm.
But it's done in red and black, vivid red and black. And you just feel this sense of inner chaos that's a part of the figurative piece as well as the abstract piece. It's a really strong piece.
Yes, these are, I agree with you. They're extremely powerful images. And Kay's husband, Michael, died very suddenly in 1989 after they'd been married for some 30 years. And this, as you might imagine, was a really difficult time for her. And she was able to process her grief through her painting and her artwork. And there's a couple of these paintings that are very dark colors, but where she's working up at Cornell in Ithaca, New York, and looking over the stunning landscape in that part of the country, at these gorges that are cut through the town and the college campus with very, you know, waterfalls and tumbling water below. And she's, you know, watching these scenes and really painting the rushing water through the gorges as a sort of physical embodiment of her own grief. And these places are, the places hold very deep sadness. They're also a location where many students have committed suicide. So they are beautiful places, but they also carry a lot of emotion and a lot of weight for Kay and for many others. And I think it was a way of working through what she was feeling and then pairing that with an abstract image that, again, perhaps represents the emotion, represents her feelings for her husband, and perhaps a sense of his presence or even of the lack of his presence. So it's, again, that physical world with the intangible.
Yeah. As the exhibit continues, you see she spent some time in Italy, teaching in Italy, and you see those Italian landscapes, again, done in a very interesting, totally original way, where you see these a couple of them have this sort of outline of a woman figure almost meditating. And it's almost like a healing, you know, it's almost like healing images. And it, coming after these series of canvases where you can see this grief being expressed, it's almost like, oh, here's the healing part next. I don't know if that's the case, but certainly you get that sense from the way the artwork is placed in the gallery.
I think that is true to some degree, and that she certainly found new inspiration in Italy and was just you know, there's such a rich, long cultural history there, and she was influenced by ancient Roman mosaics and by Italian Renaissance paintings and really everything in between. And she taught herself how to gild. So at this point, her paintings start to incorporate gilding in the sky, which was also inspired by medieval paintings, you know, by artists like Duccio. And she's even starting to seek out Italian artworks in New York. So one of the works that we have in the show is inspired by a painting that's in the Frick collection.
Hmm.
So it's a really and the titles here also show that her, you know, her emotional state's changing. You know, one of the works is titled, you know, Gioioso, which is the mm-hmm. Italian word for joy,
yeah.
Or Il Sogno, Il Regalo, which is the dream, the gift. And she's seeing these places and really in bringing her own, sensibility to them. But it's a beautiful series, still often using that diptych format of works that react to the Italian landscape and to the history there and to where she sees herself in that story.
And then when you look at the last section of the show, you see her traveling around the West. We talked about her fascination with the story of Chief Joseph and the Nez Perce, another series of very different pieces that are showing the Nez Perce crossing, the Wolova Mountains, also a piece called October 5th, 1877, which was the day that I believe Chief Joseph surrendered. Yeah. And it features this set of faceless figures, you know, with black shawls over the head, hooding the figures. Very strong piece. Over Lolo Pass, which shows feet going in procession. This was their escape route, trying to cross a pass to get away from the soldiers that were chasing them, trying to take them back to a reservation. So you can see her coming back to the story and painting the Northwest, painting the Southwest, painting all sorts of places where she's going.
Yes, and I think one of the most powerful works from this series is she's really exploring the American landscape and, again, placing the Native American history and Native stories back into these places. One of these works is called Farewell to the Smokies, and it's this beautiful mountain landscape. It's two panels. One of them shows a lush green landscape. One is perhaps a winter landscape with dull earth tones and browns and beiges. And then you notice across the bottom there's a very small line of figures walking across the bottom.
Procession, really.
A procession. Yeah. Of figures that are bent over, figures that look downtrodden, and it's clearly a reference to the Trail of Tears and to the people who were forced out of the Smoky Mountains.
I love having been to that area several times. I mean, the foreground of the mountains are actually, I don't know if there's anything like that in the Smokies, but the backdrop is absolutely the Smoky Mountains with just the look of those mountain ranges. And it's, again, it's a very powerful piece.
Mm-hmm.
And she's never shied away from political material in her works. That is certainly very political. I'm thinking of, there's a one called, I think it's Our Generation.
It's a Where Are the Generations.
Where Are the Generations,
yes.
And
her work is not often overtly political, but there are many, there's a lot of messages contained within some of them, and some of them are more direct. Where Are the Generations was a work from 1992, and it was one of her responses to all of the celebrations around this anniversary of Columbus, you know, so-called discovering the New World. And she was, of course, rather disgusted by all this celebration of rather brutal figure of history. And so this painting, Where Are the Generations, is it's a landscape, again, paired with an abstract image. But in this case, her abstract panel's etched with a message saying that, you know, we were 20 million and now we are 2 million. Where are the generations?
Where are the children?
Where are the children? And it's a very stark landscape, even rather barren on the other side. And it's, again, I think she beautifully shows how the landscape can hold emotion and can project human emotions.
Well, she is an amazing landscape painter. She's also an amazing abstract artist, and you get to see both sides of this in often a single work. And that's sort of an amazing feat in and of itself. Kay Walking Stick, an American artist, is on display through January 7th. Laura, thanks very much for joining us and sharing some of the stories about these works.
Absolutely. It's been a joy to work with them, and I hope everyone can come out to visit.
Laura Fry is the senior curator and curator for art at Gilcrease Museum, which opened a new retrospective to Kay Walking Stick over the weekend. Kay Walking Stick, an American artist, is on display at the museum through January 7th. For more information on the exhibit, visit gilcrease.org. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.